My name's Steve Bernard, and to my right is the Honorable Nancy Lichtenstein, and my left is the Honorable Sean Conley. We're Division 7, and we're going to be hearing your oral arguments this afternoon. Have both of you received the one-page instructions for oral argument that we send out to all parties?
I think I have, Your Honor. Is it this one here, John?
Yes, sir. Do either of you have questions about our procedures? All right. The last thing I would suggest is that if either of you or anyone else in the courtroom has a cell phone or a pager that might go off and interrupt counsel, please turn them off or put them on silent. With that being said, we're ready to go.
Good afternoon, members of the panel. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Scott Larson. I represent Michael Pelfrey. I'd like to raise three points that were raised in the briefs, or at least expand on those. The first being a trial court's inconsistent application of the law to the facts as found by the trial court and to the undisputed facts in the record. Second, I'd like to comment on the trial court's finding of negligence on the part of Mr. Pelfrey based on the Mountain Highway statute, as there is no basis in the record for that finding pursuant to that statute. And finally, I'd like to comment briefly on the misinterpretation of the contractual language by the trial court in the subrogation provision of the American Family Insurance policy issued to the plaintiff, Mr. Sawyer, which resulted in Mr. Sawyer being awarded medical expenses. Now, the trial court, on the first issue, the trial court correctly concluded that the road upon which this incident occurred was, in fact, a highway. It did that pursuant to 43.2.201. It also concluded correctly that as a public highway, it was subject to regulation pursuant to Article 4. The trial court then recognized that there were particular statutes that it was going to apply to the actions of the respective individuals in this case. But in the end, the trial court only applied those additional statutes to Mr. Pelfrey and not to Mr. Truman or Mr. Sawyer. Our beef is with the inconsistent application of those statutes to Mr. Truman, who was a designated non-party. The first of the statutes was 42.4.14.12, which is the bicycle statute, which by its very language requires that bicyclists have the same duties when operating a bicycle on a highway that a motorist does. The second is the Mountain Highway statute at 40.
Pardon me, Mr. Larson. Aren't there some exceptions for bicycles that allow them to do certain things, like, for example, ride abreast in certain circumstances?
That's correct, Your Honor, and I'll get to that in just a second, but
very
you're
good.
Absolutely correct. In general, however, the bicycle statute applies to this case, and the court recognized that in paragraph 37 of its order. It also recognized that the Mountain Highway statute at 42.4.7.11 applied, and that the careless driving statute at 42.4.14.02 applied. But then the court didn't apply any of the requirements in any of those statutes to Mr. Truman's actions. I'll go through them one by one. First, under the bicycle statute, 1412 subsection 5 is the requirement that a bicyclist ride on the right side of the road. 6E of that statute, and this is what you just referred to, Your Honor, requires bicyclists or allows bicyclists to drive side by side or ride side by side, but only in circumstances where they're doing so does not impede oncoming traffic or hinder oncoming traffic. Neither one of those statutes were applied to Mr. Truman. And Mr. Truman, undisputedly, was riding on the left side of this road. There are 14 instances in the record. All the witnesses at trial that testified, including Mr. Truman, all said Mr. Truman is on the left side of this road, which, unfortunately for Mr. Pelfrey, was his right side.
Mr. Larson, let me ask you, on the statute 1412.5, there are two provisions. I guess there one's a right-hand lane, one's a right-hand side. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
The right-hand lane, I'm not sure, wouldn't the district court's findings here say there is no right-hand lane? It's a single-lane road. There's one lane. So there's not a right lane, there's not a left lane, there's one lane.
Well, Your Honor, there is a right track and a left track. And I think that the statute and the meaning of the statute, especially in conjunction with the Mountain Highway statute, would lead one to reasonably conclude that the right-hand lane would be the right-hand side of the road in this instance.
Well, there's also a right-hand side part of that same statute, right?
There is, Your Honor, but it makes no difference because he wasn't on the right-hand side, and the trial court found that.
No, I understand, but the right-hand side requirement of the statute applies only when the bicycle is being overtaken by another person.
Well, another vehicle. That is correct.
What I'm suggesting is I don't think the right-hand side provision applies to your case. I think you're talking about a right-hand lane, and I'm suggesting that there may be no right-hand lane when you have a single lane.
There may, in fact, be no technical right-hand lane. I can't argue with the court over that. But again, as I think if you read that statute in conjunction with the Mountain Highway statute, which envisions bicycles on single lanes and other vehicles on single lane mountain highways, it requires someone to operate their vehicle as far to the right as possible. Again, the trial court found that Mr. Truman was on the left side of the road. No one says he was on the right side of the road. If you're on the wrong side of the road and you violate a statute that's been enacted for the safety of the public, that's negligence per se.
Mr. Larson, I do have another question. You were referring to the statute and saying that what it contemplates is that a bicyclist must not impede oncoming traffic. Where does it say that in the statute?
I believe that's in 6E. I believe that's the side-by-side portion where they can ride side-by-side unless they're going to hinder oncoming traffic, Your Honor. And if I've added a letter there, I apologize. It might be just 6, but I thought it was 6E. At any rate, and I've jumped ahead a little bit of myself, but that's all right. The court also again, found that the careless driving statute applied, yet didn't apply that to Mr. Truman's conduct because Mr. Truman obviously wasn't cognizant of the curves in the road. This accident happened at a left-hand turn for the bicyclist and a right-hand turn for Mr. Pelfrey as they were coming toward this apex. The precipitating factor in this incident was Mr. Truman being on the wrong side of the road. Mr. Pelfrey testified at trial, undisputedly, that had no one been on his side of the road when he turned the corner, he wouldn't have had to avoid anyone. And in essence, what the trial court found in finding Mr. Truman not negligent at all was that because he wasn't injured or hit, that there couldn't have been any negligence. And that's not the standard for negligence.
Any measurements of...
There was not. I believe there were estimates of 10 to 12 feet, Your Honor, in the record, but there were no actual measurements made.
But there were estimates of 10 to 12 feet wide?
Yes. The road was not big enough, I believe, for two vehicles, two full-size vehicles to pass, but it was certainly, and the court can take a look at the exhibits if it likes. I mean, it's not a dirt path. It's, at the point of the incident, it's actually a pretty good-sized one-lane road. But I don't disagree that it's a one-lane road.
Well, the court found it was, quote, acutely narrow.
That's what the court found. I don't know if 12 feet is acutely or not, Your Honor. Quite honestly, I don't know. I don't know anyone that testified that it was acutely narrow.
That's a factual finding that we would accept.
You have to accept. And we're not here to challenge the court's factual findings. Our only challenge is the misapplication or the inconsistent application of the law to the facts as the court found or as the facts were undisputedly testified to by all of the witnesses. At any rate, with respect to that issue, it's our position that the inconsistent application of the law, which is quite clear to the facts, was error. Second of all, and this is briefly, the trial court concluded in the conclusions of law that Mr. Pelfrey was negligent for failure to sound his horn as required by the Mountain Highway Statute at 42.4711. However, in order to impose that duty on Mr. Pelfrey, the trial court had to also find that he wasn't operating his vehicle to the right of center of the road.
Entirely to the right of center.
Entirely to the right of center. That's exactly the word of the statute, Your Honor. There is no finding like that. And the reason there's no finding like that is because it doesn't appear in the record. Because everyone who testified to Mr. Pelfrey's position in the road indicates he was on the right side of the road. And Mr. Pelfrey, under cross-examination by the court, indicated that he was operating his four-wheeler with his right wheels on the right-hand side of the right track as he was proceeding down the road, and his left wheel just to the left of that track, which would have made him clearly entirely on the right-hand portion of the road.
Actually, let me get back to the statute. I don't think I quoted it entirely correctly, no pun here, entirely to the right of the center of the roadway. I would suggest an acutely narrow single lane road, there is no entirely to the center of the roadway if you can't have two cars passed at the same time.
Your Honor, this road certainly has a center, as all measurements do. And I would submit to the court that were the case, the court should have and could have made a finding and did not.
Okay, but can you, under the court's finding that it's a single lane road that allows only one vehicle to pass at a time, can you ride entirely to the right of the center?
On an ATV, yes, sir. And that's exactly what Mr. Pelfrey testified to. And if you take a look at document 258, 563, pages 64 and 69, you'll find that testimony.
So your theory is that on this narrow road, two ATVs could have passed each other?
Absolutely. Two ATVs could pass each other. There's no question about that. And the bicyclist and the ATV could have passed each other.
Mr. Larson, yes, the court made findings that Mr. Pelfrey was negligent for other reasons. So what effect would that have on the finding about failure to blow the horn?
What it would require this court to do would be a remand with instructions with respect to that issue. And also then it would be in conjunction with the first issue I raised to have the statutes applied to Mr. Truman. And I would submit that remand, it doesn't require a new trial, but that remand would require the court to take that into consideration in assessing not only Mr. Pelfrey's negligence, but also Mr. Truman's negligence. I understand what the court's saying. The court didn't conclude he was negligent in its conclusions, but made findings of fact that it wasn't negligent. And I was, quite honestly, a little bit confused as to exactly how you argue a finding of fact of non-negligent, but then don't conclude that the individual was negligent. But I understand your question.
Counsel, what about Mr. Pelfrey's speed? It was mid-20s or so as here he's approaching there, and then low 20s as he gets to the corner.
Yes, sir.
If someone had been driving that same speed on an ATV from the other end of that blind corner, you'd have 40 miles an hour. Are you telling me that that's not without due regard for the width, grade, curves, etc.?
What I'm telling you, Your Honor, is that the trial court could not evaluate his speed in a vacuum. It had to consider the position of Mr. Truman with respect to that speed. Remember now, Your Honor, there's no evidence that 20 miles an hour or 22 or 23 was per se unreasonable. What the court finds is because there was a collision between Mr. Sawyer and Mr. Pelfrey, that it must have been unreasonable because there was an accident. And that's not the law in Colorado. There are two items.
Perhaps I didn't make myself clear. As he approaches this blind corner at, lower 20s.
Yes, sir.
Couldn't that serve as a basis for the court's finding that it was without due regard for width, curves, et cetera? Because it's not like it's a straightaway and he can see forever. He's got a blind corner here.
I would tell you the same thing, that you must evaluate the speed with respect to Mr. Truman's position in mind. Because if Mr. Truman is on the right side of the road, Mr. Pelfrey testified, and there was no dispute, that he can turn the corner at 20 miles an hour and avoid everyone. He doesn't have to take any evasive action, and there's no accident. And then his speed is only unreasonable because of where Mr. Truman's location is. If Mr. Truman's not there, this accident doesn't happen. We're not here today.
Isn't this a road that he knew had people who rode horses and hikers and bikers? Didn't they know this?
Your Honor, he had been on the road before, and he was aware that there are other users of the road. And so were the bicyclists. And so I can't argue with you with respect to an equestrian user or a pedestrian because the statutes don't require the same duties of a pedestrian that it does on a bicyclist. That's an entirely different case. And with all due respect, Your Honor, in law school, it was the what if situation. And I'm not prepared to argue that because it didn't happen here. And they don't have that particular onus on them that a pedestrian or an equestrian user. At any rate, Your Honor, that leads me to my last quick point here, and that's the subrogation issue. This is an interesting subrogation clause. It is true subrogation. In our general practices, we tend to equate subrogation with reimbursement as a trial lawyer. And that's what the plaintiff has done here. This is not the De Herrera case. The language in this policy is unique because of its simplicity and its clarity. It says, if we make a payment for medical expenses, we have the insured's right to recover against any person or organization for any amount that we pay. That's what it says. In De Herrera, it says, if we pay and you recover, you have to pay us back. This, by contract, in this case, is exactly what appears in the workers' compensation statute. And that's at 841-203. It allows a workers' compensation carrier the direct right of action for medical expenses only. Make no mistake, we're not claiming that Mr. Sawyer, all of his claims were assigned by virtue of this contract. Only his right to recover medical bills paid by American Family, which was the $43,000.16 that was awarded by the trial court. It's true subrogation. If you look in Black's Law Dictionary, it says to stand in the shoes of or to take the place of. With respect to that item, we'd ask the court to simply vacate that portion of the judgment on remand. And I'm out of town, right on the money.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Gertz. So I tried the case with Richie Cummins in the court below, and we notified the court clerk that I would be arguing the case. I hope the court received notice of that. Paul Gertz is my name. May it please the court, I got to hear a little bit of the last case that you were considering the tri-court case, and I think this is a lot simpler case than that last one, and I don't envy you your task in figuring out all that stuff. This is a basic, just ATV running into a bicycle on a dirt road out in the country. It's a simple negligence issue. An experienced trial judge heard evidence over a couple of days, saw all the photographs, saw all the witnesses, judged the credibility of the witnesses, judged their demeanor, is familiar with the territory out there, and came up with the finding that this man was driving his ATV too fast to avoid a collision, coming around a blind curve on a road that's used by hikers, bicyclists, horses, cars, trucks, every type of vehicle you can think of. We think the findings are supported by competent evidence, and we think the findings are certainly not clearly erroneous, and that's a standard I believe the court should apply here. The key findings, in our view, are number 20, which is a factual finding saying that Mr. Truman, the non-party at fault who was named in the case and who testified in this case, was not negligent in his riding in this single-track lane road out in the country. And findings 25 through 29. Findings 25 through 29 are basically the summary of what the court found Mr. Pelfrey had done wrong in operating his ATV. He didn't take into account the terrain of variations and the obstructions to visibility on this blind curve. He didn't keep a sufficient lookout. His speed was too fast to stop, and he didn't see the plaintiff in time to stop his vehicle. One of the key findings in this case, we believe, are number 29, and that is that the court finds causation for the collision to be the speed at which defendant was operating the ATV. Regardless of which one of these statutes, and you know, none of them fit perfectly the facts of this case, and I don't think they were designed with that in mind, but regardless of which statute applies, the finding number 29 is sufficient to support the judgment of the court. The court finds causation for the collision to be the speed at which defendant was operating the ATV. We may disagree with counsel, Mr. Larson, about which facts are disputed and which ones weren't, but there is no dispute about the speed this ATV driver was going. As the court noted, he was going in the mid to low 20s around the blind curve, and it's very clear on cross-examination that he admitted that he was going so fast that he could not stop his vehicle in time. And that's just classic, basic, ordinary negligence. In the conclusions of law, number 40, the court really made two findings within number 40. The number one finding was the court concludes that a careless and imprudent standard under that particular statute apply to the facts of the case. But then the court went on to say the court also determines that the proximate cause of the incident question was defendant's negligent operation of his ATV. Now, obviously, we pled in the court below not only ordinary negligence, but statutory violations. And again, while one could disagree about which statute applied, the finding of ordinary negligence, in our view, supports the judgment of the court, does not require remand, because whether this court agrees with everything that the trial court found, we don't have to send it back, in my view, to correct alleged misapplication of the statute. If there's competent evidence to support the judgment and the findings are not clearly erroneous. Mr. Larson has not attacked the finding that there was excessive speed considering the circumstances. That was a finding of fact by the court that's supported by the evidence, and we believe that supports the judgment.
So, Mr. Gertz, if I understand your argument, you're saying the court's findings supported ordinary negligence and were not related, such as the finding of excess speed, to the negligence per se claims.
Yes, Your Honor. I think he made two findings within this paragraph number 40. The court concludes that a careless and imprudent standard, and he's quoting above from the statute above, applies to the facts of this case. Then he says the court also determines that the proximate cause of the incident question was defendant's negligent operation of his ATV. So whether you have a statutory negligence per se violation or whether you have just ordinary plain old negligence, we believe there's abundant evidence to support either one of them. I had some notes about arguing the standard of review, but you know that much better than I do, and I just say that there's certainly been no showing here of any clear error on the part of the trial judge. The bicycle statute that the court was asking about earlier, we believe that it doesn't strictly apply here where you're talking about a situation where there are no lanes. It was not written for that. In my view, it was designed to cover a situation where you're out on a paved county road or a paved public highway of some type, and there are clearly markings of the lanes. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense for the legislature to talk about allowing bicyclists to ride side by side. That would imply that it would be okay for one to be riding in the left lane and the other to be riding in the right lane, which doesn't make any sense. The motor vehicle laws apply except where they don't apply by their mere wording. In other words, the court has to use some discretion in deciding what the legislature intended and what applies to the facts of this particular case. We just don't think the bicycle statute supports the position being taken here. The sudden emergency doctrine that he argues is pretty easy to deal with. It obviously doesn't apply. If I create a sudden emergency on the street and cause a collision of some type, I can't rely upon the sudden emergency doctrine to get me out of the hot water I'm in because I caused a collision. Just as simple as that. The subrogation claim issue is very simple. The case he actually cites and tries to distinguish is so close in language that there's not, in my opinion, much difference at all in the policy language. But as a practical matter, the record contains a letter from the insurance company in which they're clearly saying American Family has no desire to go down to Eagle County, Colorado, and try a case to recover $43,000. What we want you to do, counsel, you recover the money and send us the check. That's what they do, and that's the real life situation here. There was no assignment by anybody of any claims to American Family in the sense of an assignment of a cause of action, which could have been done had it been done properly. The word assign is not even used in that particular paragraph. It's a plain vanilla subrogation paragraph. It's not well written, I'll concede that, but nonetheless, the import of it and the facts of this case are that we will have an obligation, if we ever collect the money in this case, we will have an obligation to work out something with American Family to send them a check to satisfy their subrogation interest.
Is it your position that's between your client and American Family?
Yes, Your Honor, it certainly is. It's no standing for Mr. Pelphrey to even argue that the money somehow should have been recovered by American Family in this case. It's not Mr. Pelphrey's money that was expended. It was American Family's money. So if anybody is aggrieved, and they're certainly not since we won the case, and eventually, hopefully, we'll recover the money. If anybody were aggrieved, though, it would be American Family if somehow we did something to jeopardize their right of recovery. For example, if we had filed suit and specifically excluded medical expenses and somehow cut American Family out of any recovery on that basis, then I think they would have a basis for being upset about it and being aggrieved and maybe have a right to bring a separate cause of action themselves against Mr. Pelphrey. But that's not the situation here. We handle this case just like we have handled hundreds and hundreds of other cases of the same nature, and that is we sue on behalf of the injured party, we contact the insurance company, and we work out something on the subrogation because we have done all the work to recover their money. They normally take into account a reasonable attorney's fee and some expenses, and we work it out this way.
The whole basis of the collateral source rule, is it?
Yes, certainly. Thank you.
All right, counsel. Mr. Larson, you are out of time. And so we shall determine that these arguments are now concluded. We thank you very much for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted.